He has a master's degree in theology and letters and is a humanities teacher with Kepler Education. His talk this evening is titled Re-Enchanting History in an Age of Woke Ideologies and Christian Nationalisms. Let's give him a hand as he puts on his microphone.
So a few months back, I logged onto Twitter, and I found it ablaze with outrage. I'm sure you're shocked by that. So, but this time, it was over Daryl Cooper's claims on the Tucker Carlson show that World War II's real villain was Churchill. And suddenly, everyone online felt the need to give their opinion on World War II, regardless of whether they knew anything at all about Churchill, World War II, or even what Daryl Cooper had said. One response appeared in a YouTube video from Reformed pastor Douglas Wilson, who stated that he was not so much troubled that people were raising questions about Churchill and the Second World War, but rather that conservatives had, as he put it, gotten suckered into the popular pastime of pulling down statues. And he went on, "A people put up markers to indicate the places and heroes and events that unify us, and no one should be allowed to pull down a statue until they can explain to us why the statue was erected in the first place and what role it plays in the current stability that we all enjoy." Now, if someone looked to the talks that I've given in the past here at the George Buchanan Forum, it would be reasonable to ask, I think, if this applied to me. From questioning the American Constitution and our popular myths around World War II, to examining the history of the CIA and debunking the post-war consensus, regardless of my intentions, is this perhaps just not the right time to be encouraging doubts about our cultural myths? Is this just helping woke mobs to tear down ancient boundaries? I think it's a good question. Wilson goes on to include what he describes as a necessary addendum. And he says, "I also don't want anyone to come near any of our society's statues and memorials with arms full of rope, tackles, and poles, unless they are prepared to explain to us what statues are going to replace the ones that are to be torn down. This I reply, fair enough. Culture wars are always narrative wars between sacred stories, and the culture war between the post-liberal left and right is primarily an attempt to understand how we identify with communities and how we derive meaning from their intergenerational memory. So the recent outrage over Daryl Cooper's remarks on how we ought to remember World War II is more than just an academic dispute. So much of this discussion is the crux of the culture war, because World War II has provided our civilization with the myth that we built our meaning around. Just before the World Wars, Nietzsche had warned that Western culture was in the process of losing the sacred principles that had held it together. We had killed God, but without providing a replacement for him. However, the devastation of the World Wars, Hitler, the Holocaust, allowed us to squeeze another 80 years of life out of our decaying morality. We may have killed God, but at least we still had a Satan. As one historian wrote, "We live in the age of Hitler. Our religion is World War II." Americans were told that if old nationalist identities centered around blood and soil had led to Hitler and the Holocaust, then an open society maintained by universal propositions of equality and democracy would be used to build a new liberal international world order. And this post-war consensus united both the left and the right in a shared moral rhetoric. But as World War II moves from living memory to a remembered past, our culture has begun to awaken to the fact that the meaning derived from this myth has a shelf life. For the past 80 years, Americans have popularly held to the belief that as a propositionally founded nation, we were not only capable of ushering in the end of history, but it was our duty to remake the world in our own image. And although this has been questioned at certain points in our history, it wasn't seriously challenged until 2019, when the New York Times published the 1619 Project. The 1619 Project reoriented America's founding from Europeans fleeing persecution in pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness to claiming, in the words of the project's producer, Nicole Hannah Jones, that slavery is a foundational American institution. And the goal here was not merely to make the 1619 Project a new addendum to our national mythology, but by placing slavery as the focal point of our narrative, it removes from our history an American golden age. There's no American Garden of Eden. There was only ever the fall and our sin to do penance for. And this is not just a call for a symbolic or a spiritual penance. For Nicole Hannah-Jones, the conservative response that, well, no one alive today was enslaved is inadequate. She argues that if we recover the suppressed history of government efforts to hinder Black assimilation and wealth accumulation long after slavery, then we'll realize that there is an ongoing debt. The 1619 Project's emphasis on history as social justice took on a new dimension when, following the killing of George Floyd, people began actively destroying and defacing the physical symbols of the old history. Jacobin magazine defended these actions, arguing that their actions are bringing closer scrutiny on the figures these monuments celebrate, allowing history to be retold from the viewpoint of their victims. And the same article goes on, whether they are toppled, destroyed, painted, or graffitied, these statues epitomize a new dimension of struggle, the connection between rights and memory. Rights and memory. Again and again, we see them making this point that our memory of the collective past ought to be derived from our theory of rights and the self. Our modern society is steeped in the belief that communities are just simply social constructs. Only the self is real. In the words of Carl Truman, psychological man and expressive individualism shape the dominant understanding of what it means to be a human self in this present age. And thus, meaning lies with the human self as constructive agent. Only the secret self is sacred. And anything that impedes our ability to express our will is a violation of those sacred rights. And this includes power structures, hierarchies, social norms, our own physical bodies, and certainly intergenerational narratives. So national history, then, is communal oppression of the individual's will by past generations. So it's not surprising that iconoclasm spread from Confederate monuments in the South to all public statues everywhere. As one British author wrote in The Guardian, statues should be taken down because I think all statues should be taken down. My sense of self-worth is not contingent on seeing those who represent my viewpoints, history, and moral compass forced on the broader public. That is my truth. You tell me yours. It's all very polite. But I'm not the first to observe that sacralized radical individualism is politically unsustainable, and that it inevitably requires all exterior selves to be brought into subjugation to the self. As Karl Popper observed, the only thing the tolerant society cannot tolerate is intolerance. And thus, ironically, this leads to a totalitarian democracy where each man competes for the power to force all other men to acknowledge what is right in his own eyes. But it's not simply enough to impose power by force. It requires a communal historical myth, as neo-Marxists such as Antonio Gramsci and Herbert Marcuse have observed. According to them, the liberal open society fails to provide an accurate account of power because rather than emerging from within society, national narratives are the product of power politics between competing political identities. The resulting hegemonic narrative is then used to other minority groups and deny them equal rights within the political structure. Everything descends to what Plato described as the political master-slave dynamic, which the left is rightly and wrongly eager to invert for their own narrative. And this is why conservatives have complained that, quote, the radical assaults on America's past are not attempts to be honest about the messiness of history or the fallenness of man, but are in fact attempts to undermine, scorn, and reject the entirety of the American project, unquote. And many on the left, they agree. And it's not surprising that the 1619 Project utilizing the new history of capitalism to claim that contemporary white American wealth is the result of 19th century black slave labor, has become part of the new left's universalist political program to arrange humanity, not each according to their need, but according to the intersectionality of their class, sex, and race. So, heritage conservatives have loudly denounced the left's attempt to rewrite American history. But in recent years, there's been a new addition to this pushback and the appearance of the Christian New Right, an influential part of the Christian nationalist movement. The Christian New Right sharply contrasts itself with the restorationism of the heritage conservatives, arguing that the totalitarian left is the logical outcome of the secularly neutral liberal post-war consensus, and that the boomerality of Cold War National Review conservatism either aided the new left in coming to power or was impotent to stop it. In the words of Samuel Francis, American conservatives are beautiful losers. To these American conservatives, however, the Christian New Right's condemnation of figures such as Churchill, Ronald Reagan, William F. Buckley, and even Russell Kirk, this just looks like more leftist historical iconoclasm, threatening the stability of the national myth. But to the Christian New Right, these conservative figures and the post-war consensus that they represent are responsible for national peace and prosperity, just like credit card debt is responsible for wealth. I don't disagree. But the Christian New Right maintains that we cannot reform our way back to an American golden age because the left has already waged and won its cultural revolution, and so the only way to defeat it now is with a counter-revolution. In the words of Paul Gottfried, there may be no way back to what has been resoundingly repudiated and what took generations to collapse. Only an equally determined collectivism can effectively resist those who have ended the liberal era. Equally determined collectivism. In other words, the only way to successfully fight the left's identity politics is to play the same Game of Thrones, but with an even more powerful counter-political identity. In fact, what is needed is an identity empirically rooted in political realism, one that reflects the power of particular blood and local soil. As Rusty Reno puts it, we are facing the return of the pre-war strong gods. Recently, some people adjacent to the Christian New Right have expressed confusion and concern about the emergence of white supremacists, Nazis, and fascists. People calling for a great man to rise up and seize the political crown, a Christian Caesar, an American Pinochet or Franco, or a 21st century Napoleon. My own personal favorite candidate that I heard proposed was that maybe it would be Mark Driscoll. But rather than being a recent aberration, leading figures within the Christian New Right have, from the outset, based their theories of political power politics, magisterial sovereignty, and political friend-enemy distinction and identitarianism in Nazi and neo-Marxist political writings. This is why the theories of neo-Marxists such as Antonio Gramsci and Herbert Marcuse, Machiavellians such as James Burnham and Samuel Francis, and Nazis, such as the crown jurist of the Third Reich, Carl Schmitt, are being promoted by articles published in First Things, Chronicles Magazine, American Reformer, American Mind, and the American Conservative. Contrary to the claims made by the Liberal International Order, members of the Christian New Right deny political universals. For them, the purpose of the civil magistrate is not to administer an unobservable divine law. Nor can there be any appeal to abstract theories of individual rights, liberty, or even humanity apart from their historical development by particular societies. In opposition to the left's radical individualism, the Christian New Right defends a social holism where the community itself is a collective actor, ruled by a sovereign civil magistrate whose task is to bring that community to a self-awareness of their collective identity. The triumph of the will is thus not an individual private will. It is a social political will. The civil magistrate is able to accomplish this not because he submits to some rule of law, but because he operates above and prior to the legal constraints that govern the people he rules. And he uses his power to compete in the Hobbesian struggle against rival political identities. Once victory and order have been achieved, the magistrate then enforces laws that reflect and protect his society's customs and norms. He alone can organize and orient the nation towards its civic virtue and common good. In other words, never mind the great man behind the curtain. He's supposed to be there, so long as he's our great man. Although the Christian New Right makes frequent use of Carl Schmitt to defend its political friend-enemy identitarianism, it also relies extensively on the pagan philosophers and the civic structures of the Greek and Roman city-states. And these pre-Christian temple states, before there was any concept of the division of religion and politics or of individual rights, people's identity and legal status was formed and oriented by their participation in the civically organized worship of the city's unique gods and familial veneration of their political ancestors. And thus, the Christian New Right claims that since the physical church and all public organizations exist within and are sustained by the peace established by the magistrate therefore exists outside of and above the ecclesiastical church. According to Stephen Wolfe, the author of The Case for Christian Nationalism, while the magistrate is not a spiritual mediator, he does directly mediate Christ's civil power. Wolfe thus describes this magisterial Übermensch as an instrument for eternal life, a national God who is the closest image of God on earth. And he quotes Henry Bullinger saying, "There is more true virtue in one political man who governs the commonwealth and does his duty truly than in many thousands of monks and hermits." Wolfe argues that this civil point of contact with the divine is necessary because, quote, "sharing the imputed righteousness of Christ provides no means of cooperation, covenant, consent, or deliberation to achieve the most basic goods of civil society. It doesn't provide a common language, let alone common laws, customs, or culture," unquote. To think otherwise, Wolfe declares, is moronic. Wolfe goes on to say that spiritual unity is inadequate for formal ecclesial unity, and that only civil fellowship is what makes strong church fellowship possible. And this civil fellowship then requires a people to have an inherited political and cultural identity. And so the magistrate is tasked with uniting his people towards a politically oriented, intergenerational civic love for national land, ancestors, and objects, thus creating a national partnership of the dead, the living, and the unborn. And just as Roman children had read the political biographies written by Plutarch and Cato, and venerated the busts of their familial ancestors, our own public imagination and civic virtue need to be rekindled with filial piety for our Christian founders, our Protestant ethos, and our common law inheritance. There are calls to man the cultural ramparts with biographies of forgotten American heroes, such as Robert E. Lee, Christopher Columbus, John C. Calhoun, and the Puritans, the stuff of heroes, deserving of veneration and inspiration and repetition. We need national heroes to perpetuate the political identity. And this is why they see the left's iconoclasm against historic identity as an existential national threat. When the woke barbarians are at the gates, we must have ready at hand myths of great men that it can encourage us to do whatever is necessary and morally expedient for the protection of the city. Politics is about winning, and we want to win. But ironically, even though the city is ruled by a priest king here, tasked with bringing heavenly order to earth, ultimately his sacred political power is only maintained through his ability to wage death. Neither the magistrate, nor the city, nor the city's myths participate in any higher order of being. As Plato describes in his analysis of the city, the sacred nature of these myths is merely a useful political fiction. We imagine that these narratives hold their authority because they descend from the gods, But in reality, they emerge from the political identity's will to power. And thus, without any eternal participation, the national myth is self-referential, unable to transcend or maintain itself, and so is condemned to decay, and with it, the social order of the culture that it is tasked with perpetuating. Looking around, this seems to be where we are right now, a failing culture with a dying myth. So where do we get a new myth? Well, myths can't just be created. They must be culturally inherited. And contrary to the progressive theory of development, what we need is a pilgrim's regression to the old myths, the ones that gave our ancestors meaning. We need a sacred myth that can transcend the mortal state. Throughout the Bible, there's a continual pattern of fallen humanity attempting to find identity and gain power by building a monolithic city of man. But then God, in his mercy, responds by dividing and separating it. Following the flood, the entire world was assembled as a single nation at Babel. But Yahweh confused their language, ending their attempt to raise the earthly city into heaven. But then Yahweh reaches into the division, and then he draws out from it a single man, naming him the father of the nations. And from that man, a single people in Israel, Yahweh declares them to be a priestly nation with Yahweh as their king, so that through Israel, heaven would be brought to earth and the nations restored into Yahweh's kingdom. However, Israel rejected Yahweh and demanded a king like the other nations. And so he gave them one. But he promised that one day, this kingship would also be redeemed. The promises made to Israel ultimately found their fulfillment in the Christian church, and Israel's kingship was realized in the lordship of Christ. The national division of Babel was reversed when heaven descended to earth, allowing all nations to hear the declaration of Christ's kingship in their own tongues. The apostles took this message and declared it to the pagan nations that there was neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, and that as the bride of Christ, they were called to forget their people and their father's house and take their husband's name. In the words of one contemporary writer, the Christians existed as citizens of another nation. Every foreign land they call home, and their homeland they call a foreign land. But by identifying as citizens of another nation and refusing to pray to the priest emperor, Christians threatened the integrity of the temple state's political peace and order. So the magistrate persecuted the Christians, but their blood became the seed of the church. When the persecution ended and the emperor declared himself and the Roman temple state to be Christian, many began to turn to this new Tower of Babel for their identity. But when this imperial order in turn came crashing down, many Christians found themselves where we are today, searching for a mythic identity. And it was into this cultural dislocation that Augustine wrote his famous work, The City of God, describing the histories of the two cities, the one descending city of man and the ascending city of God. He said that the city of God, visibly identified in the physical church, alone could unite the spiritual and the temporal, providing the community with an orientation towards their eternal end. Augustine wrote another work, The Confessions, a biographical account of his salvation and his personal relationship with God. And he describes there how through the grace of being conformed to the Imago Dei, his will brought into alignment with the divine law, enabling him to discern good and evil. And the tablets of the law, once written in stone, are now inscribed upon the heart. These two works, examining the life of the sacred self and the sacred city, defined the next 1,000 years of medieval thought, including their conception of man as microcosm and the Christian paradox of the one and the many and the temporal and the spiritual. Man, made in the image of God, is naturally designed to transcend himself and participate in union with the triune God while yet retaining his identity. He exists not merely as a part of a whole, but complete within a hierarchical relationship of other complete wholes. The self does not exist prior to the society, nor society to the individual. They exist in a simultaneous relationship with one another and the divine. In this way, both man and his society are self-actualized through a growing relationship of giving and receiving. And by willingly participating in the city of God and Christ's kingship, earthly nations and governments are not done away with, but are reoriented towards their public end. And so, contrary to the modern state's claim of sovereignty, the city of God is the public and political cause and not the effect. Thus, while some have described the global church as transnational, it would be more appropriate to describe it as supranational. Christianity transformed the way that ancient man identified himself and his relationship to the community and the city. So at the same time that Augustine was writing the City of God in his Confessions, the popularity of the Roman political biographies and national and military histories came to be replaced by two very unique forms of Christian history: the saints' lives and the ecclesiastical histories of the church. Where modern man sees church history as a mere subset of human history, medieval man saw history first and foremost as God's divine stage, where history is inherently religious history. Medieval regionally defined communities centered their own histories around their entrance into the church, while individuals looked to the lives of international saints as holy examples. These ecclesiastical and biographical narratives were then woven into three related medieval concepts of time: the temporal time of the Christian liturgy, which is cyclical; the time of the saints, which is linear; and finally, the eschatological time, which is the history of God's ultimate work of judgment and salvation. Eschatological history started not at the beginning of linear time, but with the point that united all of human time, the incarnation. Christ is the historical figure who reshapes human history, and the church is his people, united with him, growing in his likeness and participating in his work of redemption throughout history. And the church is thus an embodied, communal, sacramental life, participating in a historical identity. By engaging in the sacred rites of the weekly liturgy, both the individual and the community are regularly brought into the divine presence and into a growing, ascending union with the triune God and with one another. And for the medieval community, this was further accomplished through the yearly cycles of the liturgical calendar, by individually and communally following and enacting the life of Christ through the events of his birth, life, death, and ascension. Added to this cyclical and eschatological time was the history of the lives of the saints. By far the most popular book of the Middle Ages was the Golden Legend, which was a compilation of numerous saints' biographies. And these stories represented saints from multiple nationalities, providing all Christians with a cultural memory and storehouse of meaning displayed through the incarnate example of these human lives. According to historian Jacques Le Goff, the Golden Legend was written to demonstrate two things. First, that as new markers of time, the earliest saints were the first workers of Christian times. And second, that the shift from paganism to Christianity was an essential moment in the coming of a Christian time that regenerated time in its essence, just as Christ had done by his incarnation. By organizing these biographies according to the yearly cycle of the church calendar, they then accompanied the example of Christ's life, providing Christians with a participatory memory of the Christian community and their identity. It was from living out these lives as their own in the three forms of sacred time that regional communities grew together toward a shared understanding of virtue and a vision of the public good and the cultural law. And the magistrate thus emerged from within the social order and the law. He was the law's steward, tasked with meditating on it day and night and then applying it. And through honoring their sacred fathers and mothers, the community hoped that they would live long in the land. But we've largely forgotten them. It's a unique condemnation of the present age that modern American Christians will often claim that intellectual knowledge is sufficient for living out their faith. I even know strict conservative Christians more enthusiastic about the yearly celebration of the 4th of July or Thanksgiving than publicly remembering the birth and death of Christ. Little wonder, then, that our identity lies elsewhere, Culture is the collection of things that hold our community's imagination, and our imagination is captured by the political. The nation state demands that it produce our myths and define the calendar of our cultural memory, and American Christians are happy to oblige. Ironically, Yuval Harari sums it up well when he says that we've given up meaning in exchange for power. But meaningless power has brought us to the age of self-deconstruction, where Americans spend their days contemplating the threat of financial collapse, rising inflation, political tyranny, ecological destruction, and nuclear war, while wondering whether the demonic spirits that will rule over the ruins will emerge from the AI or the UFOs. The Christian New Right is quite correct that we need to recover a cultural identity rooted in the past. But if we aim at heaven, we'll get earth thrown in, aim at the political, and we'll gain neither. And this is true regardless of which man God wields that power, whether that is a magisterial prince or an integralist church. In the words of the missionary E.H. Broadbent, even when the powers of the mightiest empire are put in the church's hands, they do not enable her to save the state from destruction. The only way to win the political is to return to the primacy of an eternal identity, the discarded image of our Christian ancestors that can carry us through the collapse of our earthly nations and bring meaning and order out of the chaos. We are chaplains of time, keeping alive the memory of the church for future generations. And we do this by living and reliving it. Christ, our Passover, is sacrificed for us. Therefore, let us keep the feast. It is here that body and soul, earth and heaven, are united so that we might participate in God's redemption of all creation. For in him, all things live, move, and have their being. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this presentation from the George Buchanan Forum Conference. We have many more that you can check out at our website at tgbf.org. You can also find us on YouTube or on your favorite podcasting platform. In true free market fashion, we're entirely crowdfunded by the generous support of people like you. If you'd like to help our work, you can set up one-time or recurring donations at tgbf.org. The best way for others to hear about us is from their friends. So please consider liking, subscribing, and sharing our material. We greatly appreciate it.